This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Welcome to Trumpet Hour. I'm Joel Hilliker. We have a dynamite show for you today, looking at what is happening in America right now, especially in light of what our editor-in-chief has written about the ultimate outcome, what that will be. It feels to me like a very cleverly scripted Twilight Zone episode. The drama is building as everyone behaves like Joe Biden is going to become president. Biden is picking the members of his incoming administration. All these Obama-era officials are coming back. It really is like they're gearing up for a third Obama term. Democrats are preaching about the need for reconciliation and a return to civility. They're demanding that Trump supporters accept the election results. At the same time, you have the more radical members of the left making demands of the incoming Biden administration, saying that he owes them, and they're indicating they have no intention of just going away peacefully. And meanwhile, many Trump supporters are turning against the current president. They're trying to curry favor with the next administration. A lot of people are showing their true colors. And all the while, more and more evidence is coming out about how egregious the fraud in this election was. It's no exaggeration to say that if these people are able to get away with what they did, there would never be another free and fair election in the United States. Yet still, the media close their eyes and keep saying, there's no evidence, no evidence, no evidence, no evidence of fraud. We've seen what has become of Fox News. We've seen the authoritarian tendencies of big tech and the social media companies. So much is being exposed during this time that shows you just what would happen if this were to continue and Joe Biden did indeed become president. The Democrats have promised to raise taxes. They're getting ready to enact radical reforms that would decimate the economy to fight climate change, deeply regulating coal and fracking and fossil fuels. They've promised to promote social justice and enforced racial equality. They're ready to enact stricter limits on free speech. The Biden transition team has Richard Stengel for the U.S. Agency for Global Media. He called America's First Amendment a design flaw because it protects hateful speech. He said, all speech is not equal, and where truth cannot drive out lies, we must add new guardrails. So we're seeing the death of free speech. The Biden administration is preparing to grant citizenship to 11 million illegal immigrants. They want to open the borders, bring in hordes more Democratic voters. They're doubling down on the authoritarian and unconstitutional measures to combat coronavirus. They're getting ready to rejoin the Iran nuclear deal. We really are getting a remarkable look at what this country would look like in a very short time under a Biden presidency. It's all astonishing. And it's incredibly dramatic. But amid all of this, we are waiting for the epic plot twist. At some point, very soon, the lid on all this fraud and deceit and corruption is going to get blown wide open. And the world is going to have to come to grips with a second term of Donald J. Trump. What is happening right now simply could not set the stage any more dramatically for what is about to happen. You couldn't script these events to be any more shocking and stunning and dramatic than what is actually unfolding right now in America. We are living through epic history. The greatest nation in the history of the world in its very final days, the final stages of a temporary resurgence that immediately precedes a catastrophic collapse, a self-induced collapse. So on today's show, we're going to talk about some of the ramifications of what is happening right now. We're going to start with a report from Watch Jerusalem Assistant Managing Editor Brent Noctegal about this dramatic assassination in Iran last Friday, the father of Iran's nuclear program taken out, a massive blow to Iran and to its quest for nuclear weapons. And yet, what are you hearing from Obama-era officials, the ones who were responsible for the Iran nuclear deal? John Brennan, the former head of the CIA, tweeted this: "This was a criminal act and highly reckless. Such an act of state-sponsored terrorism would be a flagrant violation of international law and encourage more governments to carry out lethal attacks against foreign officials." This is what Ben Rhodes said. And this was, of course, Obama's deputy national security advisor for strategic communications. He said this is an outrageous action aimed at undermining diplomacy between an incoming U.S. administration and Iran. It's time for this ceaseless escalation to stop. So we're going to hear from Brent Noctegal about this assassination, who this man was, General Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, and why he was so important to Iran and what his death means. We'll talk about why this happened now with Donald Trump in office and what a contrast this is to what you would see under a Biden administration. In our second segment, we're going to look more closely at just how much influence Barack Obama is exerting right now and how much influence he would likely have in a Biden administration. And this is important because our editor-in-chief has drawn a lot of attention to the former president's role in biblical prophecy. And President Obama is still very much on the scene. All those statements from Gerald Flory about that man are really taking on renewed relevance as this is being exposed. In our third segment, we're going to hear a report from Trumpet writer Andrew Miller about the dangerously close relationship between the Democratic Party and big tech. The evidence shows that social media companies had a lot of sway over this election, and we're going to talk about why this is so dangerous. Let's start now by hearing about the assassination of Iran's top nuclear scientist in this report from Brent Noctegal.
There are still many questions about Friday's assassination of the head of Iran's covert nuclear program on the outskirts of Tehran. Theories abound as to how a car containing General Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was stopped and sprayed with bullets leading to his death. Some say it was a hit job by 12 men on motorcycles. Others a highly sophisticated operation involving a driverless car and robotics that led to the shooting. Regardless of the means, the blame for the attack has fallen on Israel, and for good reason. 2 years ago, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu gathered reporters for a one-of-a-kind press conference in which he unveiled a swath of evidence about Iran's nuclear weapons program. The cache of thousands of documents and electronic files was lifted from a warehouse in Tehran by the Mossad, Israel's spy agency. Standing in front of stunned reporters, Netanyahu proved that Iran had lied to the world about its quest for a nuclear weapon. The stored documents showed Iran planned to keep going, regardless of the promises of the nuclear deal. At the center of this effort was the scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. "Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh," Netanyahu told the audience as he detailed the history of Iran's nuclear program. The scientist had already been known to observers of Iran's nuclear program. For over two decades, he had headed up Iran's covert nuclear weapons program, known originally as the Ahmed Plan. In 2011, the project changed name, but not its desire. The role of Fakhrizadeh was the same. Netanyahu explained it this way to the press in 2018.
"A key part of the plan was to form new organizations to continue the work. This is how Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Ahmad, put it. Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh. So here's his directive. It's right here. And he says, the general aim is to announce the closure of Project Ahmad, but then he adds, special activities, you know what that is, special activities will be carried out under the title of scientific know-how developments. And in fact, this is exactly what Iran proceeded to do. It continued this work in a series of organizations over the years, And today, in 2010, or 2018, this work is carried out by Sapand. That's an organization inside Iran's defense ministry. And you will not be surprised to hear that Sapand is led by the same person who led Project Ahmad, Dr. Fahri Zadeh, and also, not coincidentally, many of Sapand's key personnel worked under Fahri Zadeh on Project Ahmad.
Last year, the State Department of the United States confirmed all this by revealing that the SPND currently employs about 1,500 individuals, many of whom are scientists that were under Fakhri Zadeh in Project Ahmad and continued to work under his leadership till his death on Friday. Therefore, by killing Fakhri Zadeh, Israel has knocked out the central figure in Iran's nuclear weapons program of the past 20 years. This can't help but be a setback, albeit temporarily, for Iran's quest for a nuclear weapon. There is no doubt that he was the core source of authority, knowledge, and organization of this program, said Major General Amos Yadlin to reporters on Sunday during a briefing arranged by Media Central in Jerusalem. The slaying of the Tsar of Iran's nuclear program also comes less than a year since the assassination of the IRGC Quds Force head, Qasem Soleimani. In January, a United States airstrike killed Soleimani as he was driving close to the Baghdad airport. As Yadlin explained, both these men were the two pillars at the top of Iran's two major strategic objectives. The first is to become a regional hegemon by expanding its power into foreign countries such as Iraq, Syria, Yemen, and Lebanon via homegrown proxies. The other is to edge Iran towards becoming a nuclear power without suffering the wrath of international community before it was time. These two efforts were led by Qasem Soleimani and Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, Yadlin noted. And now these two men are dead. While Fakhrizadeh's name is likely not as recognizable as Soleimani's, nor his assassination as public, Iran has suffered a significant loss with this killing. This was not just the killing of a nuclear scientist, but of a general of Iran's Islamic army, whose life goal was to equip the murderous regime with man's most destructive force. In response, some Iranian hardliners have called for missiles to rain down on the most populous northern Israeli city of Haifa. Iran's supreme leader was slightly more restrained, tweeting in English, quote, "One of our country's eminent scientists in the nuclear and defense fields, Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, has been martyred by brutal mercenaries. With his great enduring scientific efforts, he sacrificed his life on the path of God, and the lofty status of martyrdom is his divine reward." End quote. It is unlikely, nevertheless, that Iran will forcefully attack Israel in response to the killing. As Iran views it, in under 2 months the Biden administration will be in the White House. Biden campaigned on returning America to the nuclear deal and lifting the nuclear-related sanctions against Iran. Members of Biden's foreign policy team are the same ones that negotiated the fatally flawed nuclear deal the first time. All Iran has to do is wait until Biden comes into office. The cash will be returned to Iran, and then it will be able to continue its peaceful nuclear program under Fakhrizadeh's well-trained deputies. As Lee Smith recently wrote for Tablet, it's likely that a Biden presidency would concede to Iran the path to a bomb within his first term. Smith wrote this on December 1st, quote, "It's unlikely a Biden administration will kick the nuclear can down the road in the pursuit of new and improved Iran Deal 2.0. Instead, they will move to quickly lift sanctions which will remove any incentive for Iran to make a deal and help it get the bomb as fast as possible." Put in those terms, it's Israel, not Iran, that's under pressure to act forcefully. If Biden becomes president, the Jewish state has less than 2 months to hit Iran hard enough to set them back far enough to not threaten Israel's survival during the next 4 years. Already, there are signs that Israel, with the backing of President Trump, is moving in this direction. The timing of Fakhrizadeh's killing is not the only indicator of this new reality for Israel. There are also other signs that war clouds are building in the Middle East. In the past 2 weeks, Israeli airstrikes have killed Iranian forces in Syria. Last week, Netanyahu met with Saudi Arabian Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman for the very first time, where Iran was the chief topic of conversation. The United States also moved its B-52 strategic bombers into the region last week, and this week the United States aircraft carrier Nimitz and its strike group returned to the Persian Gulf. Put together, It certainly seems like Israel and the United States are moving together towards a war footing. They are either preparing for a potential Iranian response to Fakhrizadeh's killing, or perhaps a preemptive prophecy informs us of two elements in regard to the continuation of Iranian power in the region. For 30 years, Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry has shown that Iran leads a prophesied end-time alliance of radical Islamists known in biblical terms as the King of the South. Mentions in Daniel 11 verse 40, this King of the South seeks to overthrow other nations and will eventually push the world towards war. In order to fulfill this prophecy, Iran will retain and even increase its power in the region, and perhaps acquire nuclear weapons in the process. Thus, regardless of American or Israeli action, prophecy indicates that the radical Islamic regime of Iran will remain a dominant force in the Middle East. However, before Iran fulfills that prophesied push mentioned in Daniel, it is also destined to lose some of the nations currently allied with it. By combining Daniel's prophecy with another one found in Psalm 89, Mr. Flurry has also forecast that Iran will lose both of Syria and Lebanon. Though there are cracks in its hold on power, the Iranian proxy Hezbollah still dominates Lebanon, and Bashar al-Assad's regime in Syria has been sustained by Iran's troop presence in the country. Both are still, right now, in the Iranian camp, but not for long. Time will tell whether Israel uses the next 2 months to aid in fulfilling of this prophecy, or whether it will be for a time shortly in the future. But the prophecies themselves are sure. For a full account of Iran's critical role in end-time events, please read Gerald Flurry's book, The King of the South.
Thank you very much for that, Brent. Fascinating what is happening here. You were you referenced that article in the Tablet by Lee Smith about why Iran is getting the bomb. He makes a really interesting point in that article about how when the Obama administration was in power, they were basically saying a deal with Iran is the only way to prevent them from getting a bomb. When Donald Trump pulled out of the Iran deal in 2017, there was all of this catastrophizing and warnings that this meant war was absolutely inevitable. You heard the same thing after Qasem Soleimani was assassinated in January. This is a provocation that is absolutely escalating the chance of war with Iran. And now we're hearing the same thing after this nuclear scientist has been assassinated. In all of these cases, I mean, there was no war after the JCPOA was ended. No war after Qasem Soleimani. In fact, the evidence really shows the opposite, that Donald Trump's approach to just taking a harder line with Iran and Israel feeling like they have a freer hand because they have the support of the White House has really tamped down Iran's ability to extend its influence. And now we have this, and essentially the point that Lee Smith makes is, actually, I'll just read a quote from the article. Obama refuses to accept that he was wrong about his signature foreign policy initiative, speaking of the Iran nuclear deal, and he intends to use his third term, an administration run by his former aides who are now being recast as moderates, to make it stick. They just can't wait to get back into this deal and to basically hand power back to Iran. How do you explain that?
It's actually extremely difficult to explain, and I think Lee Smith doesn't really know the answer to it. He has been probably the best writer that has been looking at the intent behind the Iran nuclear deal, and how, at best, all it did was delay Iran's pathway to the bomb by 10 years. and yet it would receive amazing amounts of cash from the United States, billions and billions of dollars from them. And so the way that he sees it, and he's correct in this, is that, and he's written about this in the past, is how the Obama administration saw empowering Iran as a way to kind of just ally with somebody we haven't been allied with, which in effect is going to negate our current alliances, which have been with Israel, with the Gulf states. And really, the Trump administration's approach has been the opposite to that. Well, let's just strengthen our allies. Let's take a tough stand on Iran, help our allies out. And it has led to actually more peace and stability in the Middle East. It's led to peace deals, flawed as they are, with all these other Arab states as well. He doesn't get a Nobel Peace Prize for it. But everyone in the region understands that if you want respect in the region, you speak tough and you follow up your words with actions. And everyone in the region knows what Iran wants to do, and everyone's scared of Iran that's doing it. And so if you get a United States president in there that has that will back the defense of the allies, you are going to see peace, not war, as a result of using force on Iran. That's not, that hasn't happened, as you proved.
The booklet that our editor-in-chief wrote, Great Again, has a chapter called The Most Dangerous Lie in History. And he's speaking about the lie that got America into the Iranian nuclear deal. That this, he called that the most disastrous foreign policy disaster in America's history. It's just remarkable to see how much enthusiasm there is to revisit that, especially given what you've seen in the Middle East since then. You know, it's been pretty quiet over these last 4 years. And for anyone to accuse Donald Trump of escalating war, that's quite extraordinary, considering the fact that he hasn't gotten America into any wars, that he's actually withdrawn America from these wars. The talk that you hear from the Democrats and the actions are just so wildly different from one another.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's the only U.S. president since Carter that hasn't entered into a new conflict. That has been President Trump, the warmonger in chief, apparently. But he has just picked the right sides. He's looked at the Middle East. He's noticed who the king of radical Islam is, who's the head of the terrorist snake. Okay, well, let's try and stop them. And he's tried to do it financially with sanctions, and then supporting allies that would eventually, you know, have to back up words with actions because they're on the front lines. And it has been a policy, though it's just a human policy, it's been one that's worked. It has brought a level of stability to the region. But here we see, and it's just amazing, going down the list of all the foreign policy appointments by Biden. He's come out with his dream team of people, and they're just names that are so familiar to anyone that remembers the Obama people.
I'm going to talk about those in the next segment. I'm just going to go down the list.
Good. But I mean, they want the Iran deal. They still believe that empowering Iran is going to be good for the region. But there is a hidden, sinister aspect behind rising Iran's power. And Lee Smith brought this out in his previous article about this. I think it was about a 12-pager a while ago. He brought out that the whole purpose of this was to encourage and strengthen the third world police state, as he called it, an anti-Semitic state. Why would a president of the United States want to promote, empower, and strengthen an anti-Semitic state? And he says at the end that this is a mystery. This is a mystery to me, to Lee Smith. Mm-hmm. And I mean, Mr. Gerald Flurry, in his article entitled The Barack Obama Mystery, which goes through Lee Smith's first piece, actually talks about the hidden agenda behind the Iran nuclear deal. And it was something as stark as this. It was, I am president of the United States. Speaking of President Barack Obama, I do disagree fundamentally with the United States and its foundation and I want to bring it down and change the system, radically transform America. I also don't agree with the starting of the Israeli state. I think that was a state mm-hmm. that was born in sin. And he writes about this in his new book, The Promised Land. There's a heavy section about Israel and how he falsifies history, Obama does, to destroy the justification for the Jewish state. And the Iran nuclear deal is a way, as Mr. Gerald Flurry brings out, of saying, of outsourcing to the Iranians what the Obama administration or President Obama would have liked to have done to Israel. We saw it. I know it sounds probably a bit drastic to people that he would want to bring down the state of Israel. Mm. But that was the path that the Iran nuclear deal was on. Mm-hmm. And we have the Biden administration wanting to jump back in bed with the Iranians, the state that has declared and sworn to the destruction of the Jewish state. That's what Lee Smith can't understand, why somebody would want to do that. But our editor-in-chief does go into the details of why that is the case.
One last question for you. The talk now is there's this brief window. It looks like a Biden administration is coming in the eyes of so many. Donald Trump is in office for just a couple more months or less than 2 months now. And so if Iran is going to be brought to heel, if Israel is going to be able to take any steps against it, now is the time to do it. And this talk of war starting, I just wonder your view on how much of the talk that, okay, war is in the offing here in the near term is more of the trying to basically pin anything that might happen that is dangerous and untoward in that area on President Trump.
Yeah, well, I think the New York Times, when they lead with a piece, as they did 3 weeks ago, that Trump wants a war or is considering a war with Iran in the final weeks and months of his time in office, you have to be very cautious about where they're trying to pin the blame or whether it's even true. And I think the window exists where Israel could act. I mean, obviously, Mr. Flurry has said that we expect the president to remain in office. If the window of time before we know that is stretched towards the limits of those 2 months, I think that we might be headed towards a preemptive strike by Israel. It seems like if you know what's coming in, more Obama, that you would act in some way to beat back what Iran has done, and maybe Fakhrizadeh's death is part of that already. If we have a space of 3 weeks before we see President Trump is back in power, we might not see a war, because why would you jeopardize that? Mm-hmm. Why would you risk that? But Israel is decisions are being made right now. There are plenty of signs, and we're not the only ones saying that war clouds are coming. Seth Fransman had a piece today for the National Interest talking about the possibility of war with Iran, and probably war with a proxy of Iran. I doubt that they would strike at the heart of Tehran, but maybe beat back their influence in the region. And that's what I propose or say is possible in this article. But there is a lot riding on Joe Biden coming into office. The Middle East is terrified of what's going to happen, and that's what's motivating these peace deals with Israel and the Arab states. That's what motivated their meeting with Mohammed bin Salman. They're getting together in the event that a Biden administration comes in with Iran yet unrestrained.
Very interesting situation. We've been talking with Trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about the assassination of Iran's top nuclear scientist. He's working on an article on this subject. Watch for that at thetrumpet.com. We really appreciate your time, Brent.
Thank you.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
My fellow citizens, I stand here today humbled by the task before us, grateful for the trust you've bestowed, mindful of the sacrifices borne by our ancestors.
When he became president, Barack Obama said he wanted to fundamentally transform America. Now, he did a lot to transform this country. He accused white Americans of having racism in our DNA. He turned race into a much more contentious issue in this country. He undermined the reputation of America's law enforcement. He was trying to put the nation on a path to federalizing police forces. He attacked the Constitution and installed federal judges and Supreme Court justices who rule according to their whims rather than according to the law. He politicized the FBI, the CIA, and other intelligence and law enforcement agencies. He fractured the nation's relations with Britain and Israel and other allies. He restored diplomatic ties with communist Cuba to the benefit of the communist regime there and to the Vatican and Germany. He coddled the Muslim Brotherhood. He spearheaded the Iran nuclear deal, which brought the radical Iranian regime back from the brink of extinction, awarding them millions of dollars to restore their terrorist activities and putting it on a path to obtaining a nuclear weapon. He slashed military spending and subjected America's national interests to international bodies that empowered America's enemies. Barack Obama did a lot to transform America, but after 8 years, his job was unfinished. There was a lot more he wanted to accomplish to take America down the path toward secularism, socialism, multiculturalism, multilateralism, essentially bringing an end to what makes America unique, limiting America's influence in the world, which he viewed as historically toxic, and ceding this nation's power to other nations. Now, as our editor-in-chief has brought out, God stopped that. He brought Donald Trump onto the scene, and he ensured that this man would win in 2016 to temporarily save the nation.
I've just received a call from Secretary Clinton. She congratulated us, it's about us, on our victory.
A lot of what President Obama did has been reversed to some degree, at least, under the leadership of Donald Trump. And the Trump presidency exposed a lot of the deep state corruption that had been metastasizing under the previous administration. Well, now we have the prospect of a Biden presidency. And Barack Obama is back. And it's clear his influence never waned that much. He was biding his time, and now he's ready to continue advancing his goal of fundamentally transforming America. This is what he said jokingly in an interview with Stephen Colbert the other night.
People would ask me, knowing what you know now, do you wish like you had a third term? And I used to say, you know what, if I could make an arrangement where I had a stand-in, a front man or front woman, and they had an earpiece in, and I was just in my basement in my sweats looking through the stuff, and then I could sort of deliver the lines, but somebody else was doing all the talking and ceremony, I'd be fine with that because I found the work fascinating.
I want to read you some reports coming out about how much influence Mr. Obama is demonstrating as the nation looks to turn the page on the Trump presidency and put Joe Biden in power. This is what Mr. Obama said this week about Joe Biden's incoming administration. So you're seeing a team develop that I have great confidence in. Well, he has great confidence in them because they're all his people. A Joe Biden presidency is really going to be a third term for Barack Obama. And Obama would have a much freer hand in a President Biden administration than he would have with a President Hillary Clinton. This is from a Spectator article from November 28th by Freddie Gray. The title is Here Comes President Joe Obama. He writes this: Antony Blinken, Deputy Secretary of State under Obama, is to be the next Secretary of State. John Kerry, the Secretary of State under Obama, will be climate envoy. Janet Yellen, a chair of the Federal Reserve under Obama, will be Secretary of the Treasury. Alejandro Mayorkas, Deputy Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security under Obama, will be Secretary of Homeland Security. Avril Haines, Deputy Director of the CIA under Obama, will be Director of National Intelligence. Perhaps the freshest face is Jake Sullivan, the next National Security Advisor, who turns 44 this week. Yet even he was Director of Policy Planning under Obama, as well as National Security Advisor to then Vice President Joe Biden. In fact, the incoming Biden administration is arguably more Obama-ish than the original Obama administration was. In 2008, when Barack won the White House, he was a Washington neophyte who had to contend with the considerable power of the Clintons. His campaign chiefs could only stand aside and gripe as Hillary Clinton, the woman Obama had beaten to become the Democratic nominee, became Secretary of State and pushed her allies into the best positions. This time, it's the Biden campaign people grumbling as Team Obama swoops back in. This is from a commentary by Lee Smith, November 17th, in the Epoch Times. The title is Behind the Scenes, Obama Never Left. He writes, Obama wants it understood that Biden is an avatar for a third Obama term. Now he can complete the work of fundamentally transforming America, as he put it in the days before the 2008 election. He writes, Hillary Clinton was expected to at least protect what she inherited from Obama, but then, of course, Donald Trump won, and he started to dismantle Obama's legacy. So what we had after that was a massive effort to reverse what Donald Trump was doing. We've actually seen what Stephen Fleury calls in his newest Trumpet article, the radical left's ongoing coup. You see efforts to block Donald Trump at every turn and to look for an opening to reclaim power. Lee Smith continues, in a sense, Obama never left. He was the first president in a century to stay in Washington after the end of his term. And he essentially created a shadow government in his home there. He has an 8,200 square foot, $5.3 million mansion in a neighborhood that's just a short ways away from the White House. The Daily Mail reported March 1st, 2017, a few years back, Barack Obama's close confidant, Valerie Jarrett, has moved into his new D.C. home, which is now the nerve center for their plan to mastermind the insurgency against President Trump. Obama's goal is to oust Trump from the presidency, either by forcing his resignation or through his impeachment, a family friend tells DailyMail.com. The fact is that he had an office in the West End in D.C. This was a perk of the presidency or the years after the presidency, but he was not allowed to use those for political purposes. So he bought this mansion and he started to use that so he could get back into politics. So that article from the Daily Mail was a few years back, and look at the fruits. Look at what has happened. This article by Lee Smith, another article, he talked about how Obama navigated the Democrat primaries. He wrote, what the Biden campaign has going for it is that voters know it's really Obama at the top of the ticket. And he wrote this about Bernie Sanders. For Obama and the Politburo, the problem with Bernie wasn't that his agenda was too progressive. The fact that the Sanders foreign policy team was so easily grafted onto the Biden campaign is evidence there is a unified Democratic Party policy formed in Obama's shadow White House in Colorama. Colorama is the neighborhood where he has his mansion. The problem with Bernie was that the Vermont socialist stubbornly insists on being his own political brand. So this is what has been going on, that former President Obama has established this shadow government there in his home in D.C. The Epoch Times says, in political circles, it was no secret that Obama had thrown his support behind Kamala Harris. She's ambitious and appealing and without any strong ideas or opinions of her own, poses no real threat to him. And she wasn't likable enough to win in the primaries, but sure enough, she became the pick for vice president. So you have President Obama's former VP as president and Obama's choice for president as his VP. And you have a whole host of Obama-era officials that are ready to step in for another term. And just to return to that Spectator article, it says, Washington's political class has reoccupied its rightful place on top. The swamp is back, baby. The Washington Post rather gave the game away this week when it published a gushing report under the headline, Washington's aristocracy hopes a Biden presidency will make schmoozing great again. The online editors promptly changed aristocracy to establishment, but the slip was revealing. Democratic blue bloods are in the ascendancy. Kerry and Blinken are about as elite as Americans get. This is what we're looking at now as we look at the prospect of a Biden administration. Now, Gerald Fleury has often said that if Hillary Clinton had won in 2016, that would have meant the end of our constitutional republic. That is not hyperbole. Look at what is now being contemplated with a Joe Biden administration. As I said earlier, we're looking at the prospect of higher taxes, energy prices through the roof, efforts to combat climate change that will destroy the economy, enforced racial equality, undermining law enforcement, defunding police, enforced special rights for transgenders and other destructive forms of social justice, further clampdowns on free speech and freedom of religion, citizenship for 11 million illegal immigrants, open borders, more of the Obama-era enthusiasm for multilateralism, turning our backs on Britain and Israel, coddling dictators, rejoining the Iran nuclear deal. And as we've seen, finding ways to rig elections on into the future to ensure that nothing like a Trump presidency ever happens again. You can see why Gerald Fleury has said this cannot happen, just looking at things prophetically. Some people have said, well, maybe if Joe Biden takes office, Trump could come back in 4 years. But if you see what's happening, you realize this country would not make it 4 more years. Last week, the American Thinker had an article called No, It's Not Time to Move On, about what is at stake here. And all of these Republicans were basically saying, look, we just can't win this. Let's move on. They said, unfortunately, this election is not like normal elections. Should this election, with all its signs of massive fraud, succeed for the election thieves, the U.S. faces a bleak future no different from that of California. Why must we continue to fight? Because it might be 70 long years before anything changes politically in the U.S. if we don't. The machines appear to be rigged, and they're all in the uncooperative hands of the Democrat big city political machines and governors. Bernie Sanders was a pilot project. Democrats stole his nomination once in 2016 and again in 2020. Anyone think they'd do less with Trump? Either we fight now and keep fighting with President Trump for any scrap of justice that can be found, or we will find ourselves submerged without remedy in a sea of oligarchic socialism. Now, that's an interesting take, and I'm not saying that I agree with everything that's saying, but there is definitely truth to that when you look at what is at stake here. There was also an article in The Stream that made a similar point. It says, with all this in mind, I'd like my fellow patriots to consider if this vote fraud was real and leading Democrats are really so disdainful of democracy, is the time for taking extraordinary means to stop them now or once they fully control the U.S. military, the FBI, the NSA, the CIA, the IRS, and the Secret Service? Once the last flickers of free speech have flickered out on social media and the last cable network switched sides as Fox News just did, once courts have essentially nullified the Second Amendment, millions of our timid neighbors have dutifully turned in their guns, once Antifa expands into every American city, that is what is at stake. That is what awaits under a Biden administration. Watching what has happened and what is happening right now really does vindicate what our editor-in-chief has been talking about in a spectacular way. What he said for years about President Obama, what he has said about President Trump, and now what he is saying about the inevitable outcome of this election. I'll just finish with a few words from his Why Donald Trump Will Remain America's President, which you have to read if you haven't read it yet. This means this nation is about to be shocked. I believe you are going to see frauds exposed like you've never even imagined. In a sense, you could say the left is fighting against God and God's prophecy. Who do you suppose will win that battle? In fact, prophecy shows that many earth-shaking events are certain to happen in the next few years. We're going to see things unfold that will astound us perhaps every week. I don't know exactly how this will play out, but I believe God is allowing it to happen this way to ensure that the evil and corruption in America are exposed.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
What role did big tech play in this past election in America? And how powerful might it get if Democrats take over the presidency and the Senate? We'll get some answers in this report from Andrew Miller.
Former United States President Barack Obama is denouncing conservative media as the single biggest threat to our democracy. In his most recent effort to increase government control over news and technology companies, Mr. Obama alleged that Facebook, Twitter, and other social media platforms need to do more to stop conservatives from spreading crazy lies and conspiracy theories. During a November 11 interview with Atlantic editor Jeffrey Goldberg, Mr. Obama said, "The First Amendment does not require private companies to provide a platform for any view that is out there. At the end of the day, we're going to have to find a combination of government regulation and corporate practices that address this, because it's going to get worse. If we do not have the capacity to distinguish what's true from what's false, then by definition, the marketplace of ideas doesn't work, and by definition, our democracy doesn't work. We are entering into an epistemological crisis." Specifically, Mr. Obama blamed Fox News, Rush Limbaugh, and the entire right-wing media ecosystem for convincing Republicans that they could not go along with his agenda to fundamentally transform America. While Barack Obama, Joe Biden, Hillary Clinton, and many others are calling for big tech companies to start censoring opinions they deem fake news, the evidence is actually piling up that these same companies tried to fix the 2020 presidential elections for Joe Biden by censoring stories critical of Democratic politicians. Undercover investigators working for Project Veritas caught a high-ranking Google executive on camera last year boasting that only Google could prevent the next Trump situation. And Facebook executives announced in October that they were deliberately changing their search algorithms to limit users' ability to share and discuss a story on the Biden family's business contacts in Ukraine, Russia, Kazakhstan, and China. Twitter went a step further and locked the account of the news outlet that uncovered this story. And a shocking report from the Media Research Center found that 1 in 6 Biden voters surveyed said they would not have voted for Biden if they had known about the scandals suppressed by the media. So this battle over social media censorship is tremendously significant. Barack Obama and the Democratic Party are trying to use Google, Facebook, Twitter, and a number of other organizations to regulate what Americans are allowed to see and hear. Ultimately, this is a war over the truth itself. The Bible foretold that truth would be cast down to the ground in the end time by an organized host of people. And so you need to understand the inner workings of this organized network, and you need to understand the dark spirit empowering it. Perhaps the biggest threat to free and fair elections in the United States is social media censorship and other forms of media bias. For 8 years, behavioral psychologist Dr. Robert Epstein, a liberal, has warned that Google can easily determine the outcome of elections by adjusting their search algorithms to favor one political party over another. Since research shows that websites on the first page of search results receive 95% of web traffic, those sites pushed to the remaining pages are nearly invisible. In a 2015 editorial titled "How Google Could Rig the 2016 Election," Dr. Epstein wrote that Google's search algorithms can easily shift the voting preferences of undecided voters by 20% or more, up to 80% in some demographics, with virtually no one knowing they are being manipulated. His calculations were based on experiments he conducted with Ronald Robertson and published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences of the United States of America. On November 24th, Dr. Epstein told Fox News host Tucker Carlson that he believed search engine manipulation shifted a bare minimum of 6 million votes to Joe Biden during the 2020 presidential election. And here's a clip from that interview.
What effect, and we're thankful that you are apparently the only person monitoring this. It controls our Google single-handedly controls our view of the world, and yet no one seems to care. But what do you imagine the effect, what have you measured the effect of this manipulation had on the outcome of the election?
Well, there are multiple manipulations here. We were also monitoring YouTube this time and Facebook and Bing and Yahoo. The bottom line at the moment is that these manipulations, the ones that we've so far quantified, could easily have shifted at least 6 million votes in just one direction. That's the bare minimum at this point that I'm confident of. The maximum, we haven't even begun to estimate that yet because we have so much data to look at.
So that's the margin of the election right there. So you're saying that what you feared could happen may indeed have happened, that the manipulations from one company, Google, may have determined the outcome of the presidential election.
Well, we've been told this for nearly a year by whistleblowers from Google. We've seen it in leaked documents from Google, leaked videos from Google. There's no question that they set about after the 2016 election to make sure that President Trump, whom I do not support, by the way, to make sure that he is not reelected. And the massive amount of data we've collected is consistent with what the whistleblowers and leaks have been telling us for a long time now. So yes, the answer is yes.
What Dr. Epstein is talking about means that President Donald Trump could easily have won the popular vote if Google were not actively suppressing positive news stories about him. Breitbart News reported that Google started censoring stories they published about Joe Biden after a major search algorithm update in May. Before this update, up to 50,000 people a day were finding Breitbart headlines about Joe Biden on Google search results. After the update, clicks and impressions to Breitbart News from Google searches for Joe Biden dropped to zero, and have remained at zero ever since. So it's small wonder that 45% of Biden voters say they have not heard about the Biden family's scandalous business contacts in China and Ukraine. Former Google employee Zachary Voorhees went public as a whistleblower last year, releasing 950 pages of internal Google documents to Project Veritas and the U.S. Justice Department. In addition to confirming that Google has been engineering its algorithms to promote liberalism and suppress conservatism, these documents also reveal that Google has two blacklists, one for websites and another for search terms. After reviewing Voorhees' documents, Dr. Epstein told Breitbart News, there are 400 websites on there that are censored on a list literally called News Blacklist Sites for Google Now, some of which are very recognizable names, some of which you've never heard of. But Breitbart News was on the censorship list. Voorhees warned that the reason he collected these documents because he saw something dark, and nefarious going on with the company, and realized that they were going not only to tamper with elections, but use that tampering to essentially overthrow the United States. For 230 years, the U.S. has been a constitutional republic where people freely elect the representatives that govern them. Now Google's board of directors is trying to change that, not by abolishing elections, but by biasing algorithms to create their own version of what is objectively true. If they can manipulate what people think is true, they can fundamentally change America into whatever they want. That is why Voorhees told investigative reporter Sarah Carter that when people see what Google is doing, this will actually be taught in universities of what totalitarian states can do with this type of capacity.
Thank you very much for that, Andrew. It's remarkable to see the collusion, the alignment between the Democratic Party and the media. That has been going on for quite some time. This alignment between the Democrat Party and big tech has really become apparent just in the last couple of years. But it is a very strong grip and lockstep between these two massive and influential entities in America.
Yeah, there is a very close alignment, and it takes a bit of digging to get to the bottom of why that is. To a certain extent, there's just the fact that the people in Silicon Valley are very liberal, so there's going to be a certain amount of what you could call natural alignment, that if the people, the politicians in Washington and the people running Silicon Valley are in the same political party, they're going to espouse the same ideology. But there's also, when you do a little bit more digging, some more like direct connections to where a number of people have tried to quantify the number of former Obama administration officials who left office and got jobs at Facebook, Google, and Twitter, and the number of even like Facebook, Google, and Twitter officials who were given jobs in the Obama administration. Mm-hmm. And so there is definitely some very real, even on the resumes, collusion that like a lot of the people that President Trump was elected, they were kicked out of office and they just moved right over to Silicon Valley and set up shop, basically doing the same job they were doing in Washington, D.C. Before the transition.
I'm reminded of a conversation we had, maybe it was a couple of weeks ago, about how there were Chinese nationals, communist officials who came to America and were hired by Google. This is another remarkable alignment that you see. You see this kind of admiration on the part of a lot of socialists and leftists in America with the authoritarian Chinese Communist Party, and you see big tech actually courting some of these individuals.
Yeah, that was another big Project Veritas expose, is a document proving that there's actually stated policies at Facebook, and I'm sure other Silicon Valley companies as well, saying that they actually prefer Chinese nationals to American employees. And so they're working to bring them in large part because China has been so successful in controlling the flow of information, which is basically what Barack Obama was saying America needs to do. He's like Republicans are saying things I don't agree with, things I think that are lies, things they think that are conspiracy theories, and people are believing them. And so the only way I can stop those people from believing them is to stop people from saying those sorts of things. That's a big order, but China's successfully done it.
Right.
And so if you're looking for expertise on how to do that, bringing in Chinese nationals is a really effective means of accomplishing his stated goal.
Well, we appreciate that. We've been talking with Trumpet writer Andrew Miller about the power of big tech and social media in America today, how much influence they had on this past election, and how much more control they could gain if there were to come to pass a Biden administration. He has an article that is slated to appear on thetrumpet.com in the coming days. You can watch for that. In the meantime, we'll have a couple of articles he's written on this subject in the link in the show notes, the links to these articles. One of them is called Big Tech Companies Are Censoring the Truth. Another is Google's Plan to Hack Democracy. You can check those out on the show notes for today's program. Thank you very much, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Brent Nachtigall and Andrew Miller. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Helen Keller. A happy life consists not in the absence, but in the mastery of hardships. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.